Hi, and welcome to Power of 10, a podcast about design operating at many levels, zooming out from thoughtful detail through to organizational transformation and onto changes in society and the world. My name's Andy Pullane. I'm a service design and innovation consultant, coach, trainer, and writer. My guest today is Tanara Schneider, who I knew as group director and then managing director of Fjord North America, and who is now head of design for Accenture Interactive Midwest. Tanara, welcome to Power of 10.
Hi, it's nice to be here. It's good to see your face again, too.
Yeah, we haven't seen each other for a while. So first of all, I want to make space for this. You know, how are you doing? It's been a crazy time everywhere right now because of COVID, but it's also been crazy, particularly as emotionally hopeful, draining to be a Black woman in corporate America. We all know that machine never stops right now.
Oh, how am I doing? Yeah. I was talking with a friend yesterday about this, and she said, I'm taking it one day at a time, sometimes one moment at a time, and right now in this moment I'm good.
Right.
So I think I will steal that from her and say right now in this moment I am good. Yeah, there's a lot to unpack in that, Andy. So
I know. Well, we'll spend perhaps the next the rest of this episode kind of talking about that, really. But look, before we do, I know you from my time at Fjord, but I realize I don't kind of really know your journey to there. And so I know you've been, because I've been digging around, you've been a dancer, a cook, an event planner, instructional designer, an executive producer. But you know, tell us, who is Tanara Schneider, and what was your journey to where you are now?
Those are two wildly different questions.
In five words or less. No.
In five words or less.
I'm joking. You can take as long as you like.
Yeah. Who am I? I am a daughter, a mom, a friend, sometimes a cook, sometimes a short order cook, because I live with my daughter and my parents.
Okay.
So, there's a lot of that. But the journey in and of itself probably starts, I think like many of us do, I went to college thinking I wanted to do one thing. I thought I wanted to be a physical therapist. I had been a dancer growing up, an athlete growing up. And, I end up at a big university, went to University of Illinois, downstate, and really thought I wanted to do something with sort of physical bodies, et cetera. I knew I was never going to be a professional dancer. And about halfway through that first year, I realized that, a biology class of 120 people in the dark lecture was not for me.
Right.
It just was not. That was not where I was going. And so I stepped over to something that I knew I loved and could do 4 years of, which was literature and English and writing. And so I think that degree in humanities gave me opportunities to find a path that, in the 90s, I think a lot of us were winding into what would become kind of the technology and digital revolution.
Yeah.
Right. So I, winding story, leave there, go to grad school for a hot minute, have a miserable experience, and ultimately find myself in the corporate world as an instructional designer and corporate trainer.
Right.
And I did that in a few different ways for a collection of years, and found myself firmly in the center of the ERP world, doing PeopleSoft implementations for HR and financial services software.
And how was that?
Oh God, miserable, absolutely miserable. But it all has a common thread, which really brings you like through my entire career, which is helping people unravel really poorly designed systems.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So teaching people how to use Microsoft, teaching people how to use SAP, eventually leading implementations and re-blueprinting the software so that it is usable for humans, because humans have enough fear to deal with, especially at that point in time, going from like green screen terminals to client server environments and Windows and everything else. So, really spent the first half or so of my career doing that. Took a sizable break, went to culinary school because I was just exhausted, and spent a little bit of time cooking. And eventually, like many of us do, moved to New York, probably 10 years too late. Had I moved there in my 20s, it would have been amazing. Moving there in my 30s was a whole different situation. there was no romance of living like, you know, four to an apartment that was way too expensive. It was really just hustling. But it was cool. It was my transition from, you know, being sort of internal. I worked at JetBlue for 3.5 years doing e-learning and set up their, helped really establish JetBlue University as one of the first sort of like big faculty members working on e-learning and focused on that, and then went agency side in New York. So that was where I really found my way into what I would say is sort of this version or this side of my career for the last 25-ish years, 24, 25 years. Really sort of understanding consumer needs and digging into that. And so that's where I was an executive producer because I kind of did everything. My first agency, I was the PM, I was the account person. I was doing, you know, information architecture and wireframes, really trying to shape out what was fairly new for a lot of agencies then. And we were doing some cool stuff in the fashion world and things like that because it was New York, and some financial services work. And eventually made my way back to Chicago through what was supposed to be a short contract working with that agency that I had left to do freelance work. But came back to Chicago to work for Playboy. Did that for 2.5 years. That was fun. That company's got a really, obviously an iconic brand, but has some really interesting stories that go with it. And, you know, navigated my way out of that into, you know, what we've now come to think of as more sort of UX digital design kind of agency world. And eventually landed at Accenture about a year post the Fjord acquisition, came in through Acuity. So Acuity had been acquired about a year prior to my arrival as well. But I knew some folks who worked there and came in to lead service interaction design and have been there for 6 years now.
And so the recent shift, you're now in the Accenture Interactive pillar until about a few. How's that been? That is really recent, actually, isn't it? Congratulations on the promotion.
Oh, thank you. It is recent. It's I think it's still forming. It's in transition, like so many things are right now. So Accenture, introduced this new growth model in January.
Yeah.
Really, the announcement was January, which was about a month after I took over Fjord North America. So it all sort of happened at the same time.
Yeah.
As many things are wont to do. And we are still figuring a lot of it out. It's gotten much more settled over the past month or so, I would say. And so now my quandary in working with some of the other leaders inside of Fjord, because we've got some new leaders who are going to be leading Fjord globally as of the turn of our year, which will be here at the end of August. And I'll actually pass my North America torch to my compatriot, to Nick, and he'll take over Fjord North America, and I will jump firmly into the interactive role in design. So it's been really interesting to watch design grow up in Accenture.
Yes.
And see what that means.
And what does that mean? I mean, I've been inside it too, but what's it been meant from your perspective? Because I think I wrote this thing about the design leadership dip a little while ago of people kind of transitioning from being, it's more about their identity being really kind of attached to their craft skills and moving and letting go of some of that and kind of moving into this leadership role where they maybe do less or no craft work in that way. But I also kind of realized that agencies and internal departments go through a similar thing, right? That they also kind of go through this. It's a roller coaster, right? It has a kind of up and down cadence where they change. So in many respects, you know, I know Fjord within Accenture being, you know, much further along the journey than, you know, many other, especially the large consultancies. So what has it meant for you to watch grow up, watch design grow up? What does it look like?
You know, I think it... I think where we are right now, if we think about the sort of metaphor of growing up, I think we are design inside of Accenture is finally sort of landed in its post, like its initial post college years. Like, okay. You know, it's like we're in our, you know, not in our super early 20s. We've sort of gotten our binge drinking out of the way. And now we're like, you know, we're, and I say it like that because I think when I landed here 6 years ago, we were kind of in this awkward teenage space where we kind of had a seat at the adult table sometimes, depending on who else was around. Right. It sort of depended on whether or not the party was really a big family party. Did we need to go sit with the kids or could we sit with the adults?
Right.
And when I say that, I think it's because people were really unsure of us. They were unsure of how we would behave, what we were going to bring, what our value was. And I think like a lot of teenagers, I'm surrounded by teenagers right now in my life, by the way. Like a lot of teenagers, you're sort of fighting for your voice and you're trying to figure out who you are in this new space. And sometimes it comes out as like brilliance and people are like, oh my God, you know, she's so smart. And then like 2 days later, you have like this strange temper tantrum because you're not being heard and no one's listening to you. And so I think we had to figure out how to really claim a space that was ours, how to add value, how to approach client problems in a really big space. And Chicago was unique. So coming into Accenture and into design in Chicago was different because we didn't have Legacy Fjord. Mm. We had Acuity and we had the Accenture Experience Agency.
Yeah.
We didn't have any Fjord. So we kind of had to make it up as we went along too. So I think that also did a lot for me to feel free as one of the leaders to kind of say, okay, I think this is who we want to be. Let's take this from our roots as Fjord and let's take this from what we know of, you know, this piece over here from what we know of Accenture and how we see our consultants being successful and working. And let's figure out how to mash that together. And it wasn't seamless for sure. But I think ultimately where we have landed now, as we've grown up, we've had some great wins. I think people have really seen the value of the way that we think and the way that designers think and approach problems, especially ones that feel like they're obvious, but ultimately when you really start to dig in to them are not and have really great value when you unravel them. And I think we have stopped in some big cases, just sort of fighting battles that aren't worth fighting. Whose label is on the PowerPoint,
right?
You know, whose mark is where. And we've started to really show value through the work, show value through things like, you know, Fjord trends, stuff like that. And so now as we step into this next realm where design really is a container, depending on the market you're in, for a number of folks, it's no longer just Fjord representing that. There's other brands because Accenture is such a, you know, an acquirer. we end up in this space where we're now learning again how to bring people in and how to be really generous and how to accept that there's multiple ways again to think about the work that we do and open that up. And so I think we're in another formative space, which will be really great. But I do feel like at least I have a really great seat at the table with the team that I'm working with in the Midwest. And so I feel both respected and seen as a design leader, but also as a Black woman, which is kind of nice. Those don't always go together.
No. Well, we're going to talk about that in a second. There's one thing I want to kind of wind back to, which, you know, one of the things about, you know, so I do a lot of design leadership coaching, and one of the things I that comes up all the time is, or really get into the whole aim of it, is to get people comfortable with the fact that that they're making it up. The part of being a leader is going, well, there's nothing here, and I have to decide what this is going to be. And when you kind of talked about that, about Fjord, not, you know, being pre-legacy, non-legacy Fjord there, and thinking, well, okay, and I've got the kind of freedom to build this up. Where did, you know, what was the inner chatter, and where did your LinkedIn profile says leader by design, badass by nature. I sometimes wonder if it's the other way around, actually. But where does it come from? What kind of things were going through your head of like, okay, well, I've got to do this. I've got to create it. What were you drawing upon to think about what that should be?
So I think I'm really fortunate to have spent the early part of my career and probably my formative years like sort of baked in organizational design and learning, right? So I actually got to watch from the inside how you move people through change, how you help people sort of accept that something different is coming. And so I think I focused less on the, like, what's the end state? Because I think there's, you know, there's multiple end states, right? It's all, at some point, it's all a journey. So you got to try something. And I have a little bit of that improvisational nature anyway. I think my dance background helps with that. So I understand, and actually cooking probably helps with that too, right? I understand the ingredients, understand the steps, put it all together in different ways and you see what works. Right. So I think those two things help. They help me just feel a sense of confidence in being able to do something, completely screw it up and recover. Sometimes recover with jazz hands, depends. but I think the things that were going through my head early on were, I know how to do this work. The people here are talented. We have projects in front of us. Let's figure out what has been working and what's not been working. And then let's start with just small changes to rotate towards something that feels like it is working better or differently in a way that makes sense. So I don't think I had a huge, like a clear picture in my head. And I'm there again. Like, I don't know what design is at Accenture right now. Yeah. We don't have a blueprint for this. We've mapped some stuff out. Certainly I have, you know, colleagues who are brilliant at what they do. So we lean on each other and, but all of our markets look just a little bit different. The market in the Northeast has a slightly different complexion of talent than the Midwest, than the West, than the South, than Canada. Right. So when we, and Europe certainly feels different because of the brands that were acquired there. So we're all trying to triangulate, I think, around the work that needs to be done, right? Jobs to be done. But what are our clients' needs and how do we use everything we have in our arsenal to meet those needs the best way we know how?
So through that, you know, there's, again, I was talking about the sort of inner chatter, there is, you know, as a woman, let alone being a Black woman in that corporate environment, there's often a lot of socialized inner chatter of like, I don't deserve to be here, or I'm being too bossy, or I'm being difficult. It's another thing that I hear a lot. And my question always in back is, do you think a man would be saying that to me? You know, and the answer is always no. How much of that was going on in your head, or how much was that going not just in your head? How much was it actually sort of being expressed externally? Was it difficult to navigate that space, or is your natural badassness managed to navigate that easier than others?
No, my natural badass has not navigated that easier than others. It's always there. It's been there my entire career. I've always, I actually believe I've had it easier than many. A friend of mine a couple of years ago called me non-threatening Black, which I thought was a really interesting way to put that. And she meant it, and I'll explain it, but she meant it in a really interesting way, which is, I am well-educated. I am fairly light from a complexion standpoint. I am very easy to put in front of audiences and on the surface, not be terribly confrontational, right? I have had conversations within my own community of, are like, you're not Black enough, right? Like, I mean, so there's a whole spectrum of conversation to have there. So when we talk about me being non-threatening Black, she does not mean that as an insult. I think she's like, there is a way to interpret the world that says like, what is your threat meter with this particular group of people? Right. So, like in the same way that like, if I was somewhere with my mom who was white when I was a kid, people identified me very much with her. But if I was somewhere with my dad who was Black, suddenly the way that I was treated was very different.
Yeah.
So, and I'm like squarely in the middle. Right. But what I recognize is there's been a moment in just about every key sort of segment of my life and my career where I have been surprised by somebody's willingness to say something to me that I feel like is wildly inappropriate, would never have been said to a man. So I had a boss, a few years back, say And I was about 6 months into my tenure,
right.
And I asked for feedback. And I said, you know, what can I be doing to improve? How can I? And he said, you know, one of the things I think you should consider is that sometimes it's better to be seen and not heard.
Wow. That's what kind of Victorians said to their naughty kids, right?
Yeah. And I was like, wow. So one, I'm not a child. Two, I recognize that he came from a military background and felt like I should be somehow, you know, consumed in the chain of command. But one, I didn't grow up that way. Two, that's not why you hired me. Like, yeah. And what I said to him was, you knew who I was when you hired me. And the work that we've done in 6 months is more than you managed to accomplish in the 2 years before I got here. So one of us has made a difference here, and I'm pretty sure it's me. And so the way that I've responded to that is as I've grown up, I've not always responded well. Sometimes, you know, you go into the bathroom, you cry, because it's offensive. It's offensive to think that whether it's as a woman or as a black person or the combination of the two, that somehow somebody feels like I need to check my behavior, which is no different than any other white person around me, and certainly most men around me. Yeah. But as my client told me last week, I am not a shrinking violet, and that's a good thing. Yeah. And I've learned part of that is recognizing that if I'm not going to stand up for myself, no one's going to stand up for me. So I have to do that, and I have to stand up for myself and now for plenty of other people who are coming behind me, because I want especially women of color to know that you don't have to take that crap. And two, you've as much right to be anywhere as anybody else. And yeah. I need them to see examples of other women standing up and saying, hell no, absolutely not. You will not talk to me like that. And I've confronted some of that at Accenture. I had a surprising review from somebody who I respect greatly, and we are good friends, and we've talked about it since. But the feedback I got from him was, you know, sometimes you make other people feel like they don't need to be in the room because you have all the answers. And I was like, well, are you pissed because I'm smart, or are you mad because of how, like, is it how I'm saying it? Like, do I need to make everyone else feel really good? Because I don't ever see you say that to the men in the room. Like, oh, well, you should hold that answer back because everyone needs to feel like they're really, really.
There are quite a lot of men really do need to hold that answer back. And that's, you know, that's the frustrating thing that it costs, you know, I'm a white middle-aged male. I'm the kind of, you know, I went to private school in the UK. I'm as structurally privileged as it gets, right? And it costs me nothing, absolutely nothing to say in that moment, hey, you know, that's out of order or whatever it is, to check out the white men, to check out the men, whatever, in the room. And the kind of bleating about that kind of drives me nuts, because I just think it's just, you know, it doesn't cost you anything to do that. And to start to kind of change that dynamic. And like anything, you know, systemic change is lots of small things and kind of changing nodes in the system and not just the kind of the big thing. I said that thing about, you know, you said your tagline is leader by design and badass by nature. And I said, I wonder if it's the other way around, because I wondered if there's actually more of a kind of leader by nature and badass by design, in the sense of how much do you feel you had to kind of put up, not just armor, but kind of weaponry as you went through that path.
I think that's a great observation. And it's probably a little bit of both on both sides. But yeah, there's a lot of armor there. There are also really conscious decisions. So, you know, not to sort of give away secrets and things of that nature, but I have a pretty sizable set of tattoos, especially on my upper body, my arms, back, et cetera. And there will be more. I very deliberately wear sleeveless shirts and jackets when I'm in client meetings. And inevitably, in every meeting, I will take off my jacket. And I do it on purpose, because it is, for me, it's a way of saying, I am one, when you meet me and we talk and we start working through your problems, you recognize that one, I'm here, I have a brain, I have a voice, I'm here for you and with you. But it's also a way for me to remind myself, I think, and others that, I control what you see.
Yeah.
And how you perceive me should not be about my skin color. It should not be about my gender. It should not be about the tattoos I have on my arms, but I'm also not going to hide things from you to make you feel comfortable.
Yeah.
Right. I'm not going to be uncomfortable because, you know, to make you comfortable. I don't think that's right. I think we should all be able to be who we are.
Yeah.
Making myself uncomfortable or shrinking or stepping back from the person that I am, doesn't work for me.
It's slightly more badass than me wearing trainers deliberately, but I've done the same thing for that reason, actually, which is, you know, I was going to see someone and I knew it was quite a formal thing, and I really didn't, you know, sort of need to put on the smart shoes and stuff, and I didn't, because I thought, well, hang on a second, I'm kind of changing who I am here to go into this. And I want to slightly kind of address or push back on the language around, you know, the adults and the kids, right? The design, because designers are often, you know, labeled as, oh, you're the kids, and now we've got a seat at the adult table and all that kind of stuff, as if business is kind of more adult. And I don't know what your experience is. You've been in corporate world as long or longer than I have, but I've often found the corporate world much more like a schoolyard than, you know, than... Because the EQ in many respects is kind of much lower. It's much more, it's narrower, I would say, perhaps say, than it is perhaps in the design world. And, you know, putting on a suit and tie allows you to kind of, it's also putting on armor, right? It allows, I've watched people, they put on their suit tie, the whole thing of, you know, it's business, it's not personal, allows them to kind of act in a way, use language in a way that kind of is armor. And protects them. And actually, you know, a lot of the journey into kind of what Mike sort of, you know, Brené Brown kind of way called wholehearted leadership is actually taking that off and being comfortable with who you are.
Yeah. And I agree. I actually have never, when I talk about sort of design growing up, I don't at all mean to say that business is any more grown up. I think the interesting thing that happens when you have any sort of acquisition into a company is that at some point you have this, you end up with this strange parent-child relationship for a while.
Yeah.
Right. It's not to say that, you know, business is any way more adult than design. Frankly, I think design in many ways is far more adult because we are in many ways willing to say, I don't know the answer, but I will go get it.
Yeah.
I don't have the answer to that, but let's unpack this. Let's open this thing up and look at its innards, and then we can figure this out.
Yeah.
Right. I do believe makes room for many expertise, like many sets of expertise, many sensibilities, in a way that sort of business in sort of recent history even has not.
Yeah.
So I think there's so much that design brings to business, right? I mean, we're also not talking about art, right? We're not talking about art. We're talking about design. Design is a set of tools. It is absolutely fit for the business world.
I mean, I definitely think it's, you know, the teenager thing is apt in the sense of kind of adolescence, right? That it's kind of neither one thing or the other. And, you know, for my sins, I always use this example. There's a Britney Spears song. And there's a line in it, which is, you know, not a girl, not yet a woman. And I always kind of think that, you know, there's that sort of weird, awkward stage that adolescents go through, that where they kind of want kid stuff and they also sort of, you know, want to be an adult, and they kind of flip between them through those teenage years. You know, the disappointing thing about becoming growing up is realizing adults don't know all the answers, right? And suddenly you kind of think, like, at my graduation, someone's going to whisper, you know, when they give me my diploma, they're going to whisper in my ear the secret to life, and it never happens, right? And it's just this lifelong journey. So look, we've talked about leadership, and we've talked about you being Black woman in leadership, and we've also talked about design, and you know, you were saying just before we were recording, you know, how do we respond to what's been going on, you know, certainly in the last 10, 12 weeks as leaders in design, not just as individuals, but not just as, you know, Black or white people, but as leaders in design? What's your view on this?
Yeah. So it has consumed a lot of my time the last bit here, in a number of different ways. One, I'll be very honest. I think when I look at my role as a leader, especially one who leads a design practice, I have done my level best to really emphasize that what we do has to be done through a set, whatever we do, however we react, has to be done through a sense of authenticity.
Yeah.
But also that in the same way we would say to a client who's trying to design something, this isn't about campaigns. It's not about fancy words. It is about involving the community around you to create systemic change, which requires a responsibility to look at everything you do, not just the things that you do when it comes to Black and brown folks, right? And that is my big concern right now too. So when I look at my responsibility to lead, I very openly said to the team, actually to the entire North America team, I am not here to fix this for you.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm also not here to teach you. I am happy to help guide this journey. I'm happy to have conversations, but please, in the same way that I think we would ask other people to come to a conversation somewhat educated, please do some homework. Please come willing to participate. And please know that it's going to be really uncomfortable. Like, this is that moment where all of the stuff we have been talking about, I think, as designers, in this notion of discomfort being a healthy catalyst for change, it's time for everyone to get uncomfortable. And I think the thing about us as designers sometimes, especially designers inside of a corporate space, is we hold the keys. We're always the ones who are constructing the workshops for our clients, right? Mm. We're the ones who are controlling the environment. So rarely are we uncomfortable.
Okay. So we're the host and decide who's invited and not, and how it's structured.
Right. And so we have, I think, a fantastic challenge right now to get uncomfortable again and to look at our own biases in the work that we do and to examine how what we might be doing, the methods we might be using, the tools that we have access to are creating potentially undue bias in the work. And are we really in a position to confront the kinds of things and the kinds of challenges that our clients are going to come to us and ask us to help them with? Because, and we're starting to see it, right? We're starting to see people ask for support in constructing diversity, equity, inclusion programs.
Yeah.
We are barely equipped to do that work, right? It's not work that we do. It's not that we can't lead them through the process.
Yeah.
But the other thing that I fear for right now as a, and I'm starting to see this as well, as a Black woman, as a Black leader in design, is that everyone thinks I'm the one who should do this work.
Right. You're right. I'm the voice of everyone, every Black woman in America.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So I'm, you know, I've been asked a couple of times to be the one who gives certain presentations to clients. So I was like, no, stop. That's not happening. We're not trotting out every designer of color so that you feel like the words are coming out of somebody's mouth who like either has agency, authority, or credibility. Like, do your homework, gain your credibility, and go give the same message. Because frankly, some of those messages are stronger coming from privileged white men than they are coming from me.
Yeah, no, I can see. I mean, it's a bit like I was saying before, where it costs nothing for a privileged white man to say, to bring up another short, and actually hearing it from that person, you know, because we all, you know, it can have more impact because that's the nature of the structural privilege, right? Which is, I'm going to pay more attention to that person's words than the other person who just keeps bleating on about this kind of stuff. And yeah, well, you know, and all of a sudden it's like, oh no, I am the problem. There's a question I want to ask around this, which is, you know, one of the things that causes bias and unconscious bias is this default setting problem, right? You know, and it's one of the things designers, regardless of what they're doing, have to be really careful of, particularly when they're doing synthesis and research, right? Which is, you know, they can accidentally be narrowing their scope enormously. it tends to happen because of time pressure as well, right? The longer you have to spend on something, the more you can kind of open things up. And as we all know, the more under pressure and stress you are, the narrower your kind of field of vision becomes. As you and I both know, time pressure, if anyone who works agency side knows that time pressure is the kind of big thing. How much scope and, you know, how much responsibility do designers and everyone else have to push back on that? Because some of this stuff is, I wrote a kind of piece the other day, and I said, you know, a lot of this is a marathon and not a sprint, right? This isn't a kind of design sprint problem.
I think we have a huge responsibility to be vocal about what can be done responsibly in a certain amount of time, right? And I think that's where I've seen us struggle in the past when we construct approaches for clients, right? We know we probably have 8 to 10 weeks, let's just say that, to do something.
Yeah.
And everyone wants the world in 8 to 10 weeks, right? I mean, there's just...
It used to be 12 to 14, only, right, as well.
Right. And sometimes it's 4 to 6, let's be honest. Like the window gets short.
Yeah.
But I think we have to do two things. One, I think we have to respond. We have to say, look, if that's the amount of time we have, there are a few ways we can approach this. It's not just about, no, it can't be done. I think we have to be able to say, here's what can be done. In this time that you have, here's what can be done. If you have the following prepared already, then this gets faster, or this can be done then. If you have people who can help support XYZ, then maybe this can be done, right? So it's, I think it's understanding our work well enough, right? It's the, back to like sort of the ingredients metaphor. If I've got an hour to make a cake, I'm not going to make a 3-tiered, you know, behemoth with like, I'm going to make like, you know, muffins. A single layer, right? Muffins, or like a single layer cake that sits in a pan and, you know, a little sprinkle of powdered sugar. So know what you can make inside of the time that you have allotted, and be clear about the ingredients required to make that happen. And I think that's where sometimes we just sort of look at it and go, I can't possibly do that in 8 to 10 weeks. Or somebody says, but I have to have everything. It's like, well, do you really? Like, let's meet in the middle. As opposed to everything being a contractual conversation, let's talk about what you really need to get done. Because a lot of times what everybody's staring at is the process and not the outcomes.
Yeah.
Outcomes, there's roads to outcomes. Sometimes there's no road when you're just staring at the steps in the middle.
Yeah. There's a kind of cascade of kind of anxiety as well that comes down quite often, where sort of, you know, someone sets a deadline, this has to be done in the next 3 months, and someone else says, okay, well, that has to be done in the next 2.5. And all of a sudden, by the time it gets to kind of a briefing, it's like, well, this has to be done in 6 weeks. And actually kind of understanding what the real deadline is, and what's the kind of fear and anxiety about hitting that deadline versus the fear and anxiety about actually doing the thing that you want to do and the outcomes you want. But there's also that kind of long tail of work, right? Agencies, it's just not affordable for any organization to have an agency full tilt kind of working with them for years and years and years. And there's, you know, for the baking metaphor, it's a bit like kind of, it's perhaps more like brewing or something, where yes, you can kind of crush the grapes, and yes, you can kind of put them in the barrels, but then you've got to kind of wait a few years for it to ferment, right? And there's a lot, and you have to tend to it, and you have to kind of work, you know, you can't just kind of put it there and forget about it either, right? So there's a kind of long tail that I wonder if we need to get better at explaining to our clients, you know, the work that they will have to do afterwards is actually more, it's just stretched over a longer period of time. Yeah, that can be a bit scary, right?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I hadn't... I think we all talk about the sustainability work and leaving our clients with things that they can carry forward. But I don't know that we've put enough energy around the sort of post engagement coaching and really what it means to get people in the mindset of doing that, and even thinking about how do you responsibly check in, right? We sort of check in with our clients. I mean, we're fortunate, I think, at Accenture that we've got client account leads who, you know, have the ability to do that. But how do you responsibly say, like, I'm going to check in on you 90 days from now?
Without it feeling like it's a kind of, I want more
sales
work.
Call.
Yeah.
Right. Without it being a sales call.
Yeah, it's a tough sell, that stuff too, right? Because I think part of the, people talk about the upside of COVID, which, but there is one in that sense that it actually has given people kind of pause in every single sense. But I think that idea of, I just need to kind of launch this and I need this thing solved, and the sort of short-termism seems to have kind of been rattled quite a lot, which I think is probably a positive thing.
Yeah, for sure.
So are you able to talk about your work with Chief?
Yeah, Chief... It's so funny. It was so funny when I posted the thing on LinkedIn about Chief, the number of messages I got that were like, did you leave Accenture? What is happening? What did you do? Including Beju, who is my boss, was like, do we need to have a conversation? So Chief is this really wonderful networking organization for women at the VP level and above. Right. And it has a particularly lovely edge to it in that it comes with a coaching relationship. So you get a coaching cohort as part of Chief. So all I am with Chief is a founding member of the Chicago chapter. So they've got, they've got groups in New York and Los Angeles, and now in Chicago. And we've officially just launched as of this week, our group in Chicago. So I am one of a small group of founding members. So we were just sort of the first cohort to found in Chicago to become part of Chief. And it is, we're just getting going, but just in the meetings that I've had, the ability to have conversations with women who are in similar spaces in their career is fairly unique. I have found it very, very difficult to find mentors and to find a peer group inside of the organizations that I've been a part of, where I really feel like I can talk about business, I can talk about my personal life, what it feels like to be a mom, what it is like to be a professional woman, what it's like to be a Black woman. I do appreciate, and I did a lot of work to figure out which organization to join. And Chief has a really significant commitment as well to diversity in many ways, not just ethnic and racial diversity, but LGBTQ+, like really thinking about where people come from, what their backgrounds are, the companies that they work for. And it gives me an opportunity to think about not just this moment in my career, but also where am I going, and have women who have done some things that I maybe want to explore doing in the future, and actually get access to talk to them and spend time with them in both social settings, but also learning settings. There's lots of, we do workshops, there's financial literacy workshops, there's workshops around diversity and inclusion, as you might imagine right now.
Yeah.
There's entrepreneurism, there's just lots and lots of ability to get together and spend time together. And when we're allowed to, we do actually have a physical location, sort of clubhouse that we can meet in and that kind of stuff. So that's what Chief is.
Sounds amazing. Right now you must be just sort of getting together is a big Zoom call, right?
That's what it is.
Yeah, they're like all the rest of life at the moment. So look, we're coming up to time. The as you know, the show is named after the Eames film of kind of zooming in and out of the universe and how small things can have a big effect, an outsized effect. So I ask every guest at the end, what one small thing do you think's either overlooked or is well designed, maybe that has an outsized effect on the world?
What one thing? I don't know if there's something that's well designed, but I would say
it needs to be redesigned too. Huh?
Oh boy, that would be hours and hours of
I was going to ask a designer that, and then you get hundreds.
Yeah. The thing I would say is overlooked, and maybe we're just starting to figure this out again, is the true nature of community. And when I think about the sort of Eames, adage, and thinking about, chair, house.
Yeah.
I think one of the lessons that I have learned so beautifully throughout everything that has happened, be it COVID or everything that's happening with social and racial justice, is we move through so many different communities in our daily lives, but all of it has sort of landed very squarely in our homes. and in our spaces. And the people that we have kept close, whether that is through Zoom calls or those are the three people you trust to see in person, because you know that they will tell you if they were someplace they shouldn't have been.
And
that's right. Yeah. I think that the true nature of community and what it means, what community really means and how it gives us life. I think we are just coming back to understanding what that looks like. And I hope for all of us that we really invest in creating community and connection, because I think there's so much power in it.
I hope so too. And I quite agree. So listen, where can people find you online? I'll put some links in the show notes. Where are you online?
Where am I online? A few less places these days, if I'm honest. A few less places, but I am on Twitter. I am on Instagram, and I am on LinkedIn. That's about it. I am not on Facebook anymore. I'm floating around here or there.
Okay. Well, people will find you. Thank you so much for being my guest on Power of 10.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
As I'm sure you're aware, you've been listening to Power of 10. My name is Andy Pullane. You can find me at apullane on Twitter or pullane.com, where you can find more episodes and sign up for my newsletter, Doctor's Note. If you like the show, please take a moment to give it a rating on iTunes. It really helps others find us. And as always, get in touch if you have any comments, feedback, or suggestions for guests. All the links are in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.